and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin. Joining me as always is Wesley.
Hello, everybody.
And joining us tonight is Chris King. He is a philosopher specializing in research ethics. Chris, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thanks for having me.
Should mention he's pretty dead sexy. Oh, boy.
Very mediocre sexy.
Oh. Oh. Okay. Eh. Sad. No, totally. Okay. Anyway. So, Chris, tell people about you. Who are you? Where'd you come from? Where were you born?
Sure. Oh, I was born in New Jersey, which is a little more of an admission than anything else. But no,
my ancestors actually spent a few hundred years there.
Yeah.
And got out in the 1800s.
So they knew. Chrissy hasn't figured it out yet, or maybe he has. I don't know.
Living high on the hog. Right. He's doing all right.
I've been out on the West Coast for a few years. I moved here in high school and left and did the military thing, and came back for college. And I went to a private Christian college that's here in Seattle and have been kind of out here ever since. I had a couple years in graduate school, that I went to in New York, but I've been out here and pretty attached to this place for several years now.
Nice.
It's a great place to live.
It is. Great place to raise a family and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I work for some research institutions, and I work in research ethics, which is just reviewing research that involves human subjects to make sure that it is relatively safe for people to be involved in, or that they have a good plan for dealing with risk, or we're going to have a conversation about risk and lay that kind of a thing out.
Really? So if there's like a company that wants to set up some sort of research project and they want subjects to come in and they'll pay them like $50, you know, to be a participant, you would perhaps check out their trials and make sure that everything's legit?
That's right. Yeah. I would want to make sure that they're getting consent and having a good discussion with participants, but then also make sure that their procedures don't include things like, you know, none of the researchers are making money off of this project, or making sure that people are well qualified to conduct the research is a big feature of the work. And just make sure that it's kind of high quality research.
Okay. So basically trying to make sure people don't do what Facebook did when they were tweaking people's feeds to try to make them more annoying or fun for people without them knowing about it, to see if they could affect their mood. Did you hear about that one?
Oriented research that kind of goes on, that's in that vein. I mean, Facebook wasn't the only group to do that, because there's lots of information about people available on the internet, and there's a really interesting ethical question about both about privacy concerns, about getting consent, I guess related to privacy, but identifying people where they are, and just and you know, those are things that are definitely worth being concerned about. But on the flip side, there's a lot of interesting things to learn about people, both for people who work in business and want to know more about their clients or the potential customers, but then also for social scientists that try to make sense of things like, you know, shopping habits or eating habits, what causes people to change their minds about things. So there's a lot of great fodder in there. But, you know, if people are careful and thoughtful about how they collect their data, then there is a responsible way to carry out and get that information from people.
Nice. I've been, from the stuff that I've seen about this whole Facebook thing, though, I really think that should have been an opt-in kind of thing, that people should choose to be a part of it.
I agree.
Yeah. I agree. I have a feeling that I might have been a victim of that, because
I felt like a serious asshole for a while. So I'm thinking they're feeding me like stuff to make me angry.
During that period, I was finding like every like 4 days, I would just reach the point where I just couldn't handle it anymore. Every couple of weeks, I'd have to just take like a day off from Facebook.
They were getting you.
That or I just have the wrong friends.
There's always that. There's always that.
If you look at my Facebook bio, it is just one word. It says asshole. So there might be something to that.
So like, how does the whole consent aspect work when it comes to, you know, ethical research?
Yeah, it can be tricky. I think, you know, well, I should say the consent process is really pretty straightforward. You know, and consent in general is pretty straightforward. We can have a conversation about it. And you want to make, the only big thing is making sure that you're talking with a person or communicating with a person in a way that they can understand you. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
that's consent's simple. Informed consent is not.
Right. Right. And an informed consent gets a little bit, it depends on the content. I'd say that most of the research that I do, and most of it is in developing countries, but most of the stuff that I see is really straightforward study designs, really straightforward study goals, things that are pretty easy to see the benefit versus the risk, and people can make and I think that people, even who don't come from robust school systems or robust educational systems, can make a pretty decent decision about these things. And this is true for, you know, educational or programmatic evaluation things. But I think that's also true for, you know, we're going to do this clean water study in your community. We're going to be passing out this filter or this device, and we're going to see if it works for you and your family for a little while. I think that that's a thing that people can get on board with and understand what they're doing. So I think that part of the process isn't too muddled to the extent that you're willing to say what you want to do. I guess it can get tricky for studies that are stage 3 and 4 clinical trials, where you have, you know, the double blind feature, or you have placebo aspects of your study. The ethical questions become a little heavier, but you know, that's downstream, and usually those studies are well supported by the time they get to stage 3 and 4. I think the thing that actually that is kind of tricky in developing the kind of research that I see is the engaging the participants, right? So a person goes to a hospital, they present for something, my nose is bleeding all the time. They go to a nurse or, you know, a practitioner, and they're like, oh, they know about a study that deals with whatever symptoms you're presenting with, or mm-hmm. whatever diagnosis they give you. And either they go ask a study team member, you know, or they refer you to a study team, and they have this discussion with you. Or sometimes it is the case that your physician is kind of an authority figure plus. He or she is not just the person who has all this knowledge, but that person actually has a key into your village and your village's health. And so when you have a situation like that, getting consent or getting participants that you aren't worried about becomes a little more difficult, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it definitely does. There's definitely a whole range of how it can all go.
It definitely can.
Yeah, definitely glad that, especially when it's coming to places in the developing world, that they are actually getting, you know, trained philosophers to help with making sure they're doing it right.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, actually, a little bit of the research I do comes in a sexy flavor. Well, literally and sort of figuratively sexy. So sometimes the organization I work with does studies on gay men or men who have sex with men. And in some of the places that we do it, it's illegal. And so how do you get study participants? You know, how do you do this? You know, do you put a sign outside of your lab and say, gay men come here for a research study? It doesn't really work like that. So you have to have creative ways of reaching out to participants too. And I've been most surprised in the research ethics world, in all of research, in fact, by how people have to come up with clever ways to get research participants in the house.
Yeah, that'd be a hell of a trick.
It is. It's tricky. There's lots of word of mouth, and something like you go to the research place to get your procedure done or whatever, and they give you a couple tickets to give to your couple friends, and this is a pretty popular way to get people in. But it's, you know, it's, you have to be creative. So
yeah. Any interesting ones that you've worked on that you're at liberty to talk about?
Well, there's a couple. So I've been working there long enough to where there's some popular ones. So there was a big, probably 14,000 person study in India on HPV. And when I first started doing this work, that was a thing that we reviewed and approved. And that study, and it's a cluster of studies really, but the big one that I have in mind, went for a few years. Study participants died for all kinds of reasons. You know, some ran away, a few of them drowned, people got in car accidents, and all kinds of things. And it was right around the time that the autism vaccine thing was kind of going on. Mm-hmm. And so there was an Australian vaccine network, I think, who really hopped on this study and sort of the adverse events list. I don't know how they got it or whatever, but they hopped on this list and published all kinds of really wild, you know, just blatantly untrue things and just lots of speculation. And it was kind of interesting to see how the world responded to that, especially the health world, the WHO, and other big health groups respond to that, and it was also interesting to see how they understood what was going on in that study. So they would tell you, you know, a couple hundred people died in this, you know, in this study, and they don't give you a lot of details about it. And you know, they're pretty much, it's an HPV vaccine study, and lots of people died. This is all you need to know. It's a problem. That kind of a thing. Yeah, but, you know, the medicine has been around for a long, long time, you know, for a good enough time. It's very, very well tested. And yeah, it was a really interesting thing to see, I guess.
Wow. Because, yeah, anytime somebody that's involved dies, you have to report that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was a part of the study or the study was a factor in that or not, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, and there's a group of people who are watching, who watch studies. They're called Data Safety Monitoring Board. It's a board of people, and they watch the data. They stay on top of the data, and there's stopping rules for when research has become too risky for people. Mm-hmm. And you know, so there's a mechanism in place. And still these people, the people who are anti-vax all over the place, they can't quite, either they don't know about this, or I'm not sure what they're thinking about. I kind of wonder, but it is fascinating. And all the deaths, you're right, all the deaths and all the adverse events are really well documented. There's even a category of I don't know. So, I mean, even if the anti-vax people were like, look, there was like three deaths that nobody knows what happened. And, you know, I guess once people realize that, you know, we're talking about 14,000, you know, young women or something like that, the three deaths that we didn't know about, maybe we want to make a fuss about that, but, you know, probably not.
Yeah. I worked in a industry where we had to, with informed consent issues, you know, always being present. And if somebody died that had ever come in and donated, we had to do an investigation. Mm-hmm. And in some cases it was, you know, literally 5-10 years later, still had to do some documentation, send it off, and see if we needed to do further investigation. We had one where it was like 3 days after we'd last seen him. And that was one where there was definitely some concern. And fortunately, we got the information and found out, oh, no, if anything, we helped prolong his life.
Right.
Yeah, I don't want to go into too many details on that.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Totally. No, and it's funny how that works. And the real shockers are the real shocker is how infrequent, even when it's measured, it still feels less frequent when somebody dies from having a needle or whatever adverse event can happen. I mean, bad things can happen. They're, you know, when you have 7 billion people, the chances that some bad thing is going to feature gets pretty high. I mean, you know, you're up to a lot of digits and stuff. So,
mm-hmm. And even if you're just looking at a pool of a few thousand, the odds of one of them dying, yeah, it's going to happen.
It's totally going to happen. Yeah. It's, yeah.
But man, that's pretty cool. What you're doing there.
Yeah, it's fascinating work. You know, I don't really, you know, I'm a philosopher of science by training, and I took another master's degree in like a philosophy of physics kind of thing. And so I didn't think that I was going to be doing this kind of work. And so when I was about halfway through graduate school, I get a call from the organization that I had been kind of working with out of college, and they're like, "Hey, why don't you come back when you're done doing your thing?" And instead of having to publish and do the teaching thing, I jumped on the opportunity, and it's been I'm really surprised and happily happy about not staying in academia.
Awesome. Well, it's time to take a break, and then when we come back, let's talk more about your education. Because okay. That sounds like a pretty interesting course of study. Atheist Nomads is proudly brought to you by Archway Hosting. Check out their low-price, full-featured hosting solutions at archwayhosting.com. That's A-R-C-H-W-A-Y hosting.com.
Hey, we're also brought to you by listeners just like you. Find out how you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. That's patreon.com/atheistnomads.
All right.
Yeah. So what was the, how was the education?
it was good. Interested in how we go from one theory to another. And that comes from a long line. There's a long academic trajectory of people asking that question and finding answers towards it. You probably, lots of people have read Thomas Kuhn's The Nature of Scientific Revolutions. And, you know, this is where everybody gets this term paradigm shift from, for instance. And I wanted to sort of delve deeper into that question. And so I basically wrote a thesis on how we do that. And then for my other master's degree, it was about the interpretations of quantum mechanics. I wanted, there's, 18 or 20 or so interpretations of quantum mechanics. And I kind of walked through them in my thesis a little bit and pulled out some nuggets and, made a few arguments that were either fresh or, wrong and just nobody, or just kind of new or something like that. And, and then get out of graduate school kind of thing. But it was really fascinating. I was a classics person as an undergrad and I studied sociology as well. I was out throughout my college trajectory was very much about asking this "how do you know" question, asking a very epistemic and an epistemology, asking the classical epistemology question about how do we know this and that about knowledge. And physics is really fair and a nice place to hang out for asking this question because they know exactly how they know things. And I think that has a lot to do with the history of philosophy and physics. It's a question that we should never leave, that never becomes outdated or anything like that. We ought to all the time be able to ask people, "How do you know that thing?" And I'm sure you guys have done that many times to people.
Oh, yes. And I definitely have, spent quite a bit of time with the whole epistemology thing when I was going through my theology studies and trying to figure out how do we actually know that this stuff is true. And actually had a professor I was talking to about some of my doubts when I was in the seminary suggesting that I switch to the Master of Arts program and just study epistemology for several years. I was tempted, but that would have been really expensive.
That is how that shakes out too. Like right when you hone in on the question, right when you hone in on the thing that you want, it's like, oh, just got a whole lot more expensive really fast.
Oh yeah.
I totally get that. In the course of making it, the ways that we grow up, I think that the other questions of philosophy are very interesting, the questions about metaphysics and these things. It was very nice to sort of laser in, hone in on this question. Did you ever find out how you knew?
Yeah. Oh,
did man. You? Dustin?
Go ahead, Wesley.
Did you find out?
Oh yeah. Did you ever find out how you knew anything when you were in the, when you were in the seminar?
Yes, I did. I found out the Bible was just a load of bullshit. Yeah. That was my final conclusion that, people claiming to be speaking for God are not reliable witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
please could you at least please cite two sources whenever you make a claim?
They're not even clever about it. I think this, I get bummed out with having discussions with religious people because they, it's just kind of a letdown. You know, you can ask a very good question and maybe you don't get a very good answer all the time. I think this is the state of knowledge and, you know, in reality, we don't have that great of answers for how we know things compared to ways that we can imagine knowing things. And so I don't let people off the hook necessarily, but I definitely will take it easy on a person who's like, yeah, I'm not really sure how I know, but here's what I'm working with. This is a pretty genuine answer all the time.
Well, as long as somebody's coming from a position that they don't actually know, but they're thinking about it, mm-hmm. I respect that a lot more than just saying, here's what you got.
I think that's right. Big time. I mean, you hear scientists all the time in giving public presentations saying things like, I don't really know, or I feel, you know, they give you a fuzzy answer about a thing. And mm-hmm. What became the answer, but
The further they get away from their field of expertise, the more they hedge their bets and say, you know, you should talk to that guy over there.
Right.
And at least love
the smart ones do.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. And they should. You know, I think, you know, it's an interesting challenge to be honest with what it is that we know. And I mean, and, you know, what comes before that as setting a standard for how we know things. I think that's knowledge that should be freely given out fairly early on. And we shouldn't have to, you know, we shouldn't be still having discussions with either people who don't know any better or people who might know better but willingly rail against those rules about the standard of how we know things, you know. And it's not just, you know, we can do a little better than empiricism. We can do a little work with both empiricism and rationalism, you know, but we shouldn't think that this knowledge thing is all end all and be all. Never is going to take up that space. And I think that's a hard lesson.
Yeah, and you know, with the empiricism side, at least that can be easily covered in elementary school in science class. And then it could also be brought into history class to how do we know that these things that we're saying happened in the past actually happened in reality.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, one of my favorite historians or one of my favorite writers has been Michel Foucault. And it took me a long time to, like, I would read his books and I just let the words sort of float over me because he wrote in this very, you know, sort of French style and would go on and on with, with the theory for a little bit. And then the examples would kind of go around. But once his work sort of settled in my mind, I really appreciated the way that he talked about his sources, because he would say, hey, look, you know, I'm looking through the records. I'm looking through the medical records or the historical records of this insane asylum. And here's what it is. And then he would lay out an idea about, you know, about what that was. But he was really transparent about what he was using as a source. And he didn't make any claims about the quality or anything like that. But he was like, here's what is available in terms of records. And I really appreciate that that flavor of academic work, because you need to know right where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And you said Foucault, and the first thing I came to mind was Antoine Fuqua, that generally horrible director.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. Thinking about it with like elementary school education, is how would you handle that part? Like with history, do you think it'd go easily in the like early years or a little bit later?
Gosh, that's you know, I would say that, you know, I never once heard all throughout my education, you know, it wasn't until maybe my upper courses in undergraduate school of undergraduate college that I first would connect something like a court document to some historical fact. It never even occurred to me, you know, and there's a lot of court documents out there. You know, people get married and divorced. People are born and they die. And these are facts. And they're court documents. They're not held by, you know, the hospitals might house some of that stuff, but these are legal documents. And, you know, so demographers, you know, have it kind of easy in terms of getting data. And I think the struggle, you know, in that discipline is probably just to dig deeper, you know, or whatever it is. But if you're a historian, you know, there could be alternative, you know, documents, you know, and so I think there's definitely some work to be done in terms of which historical document, you know, so this court in this county says this thing happened, and you can go to a court, to a county courthouse in the next county, and you might get a slightly different thing about the same historical fact. I mean, they're not going to disagree so much that it's worth quibbling about, but you might get a little difference, I guess. Mm-hmm. You can do a little spinning, I guess.
Yeah, and then you can find the newspaper articles from the time period.
Right.
They're all going to be a little bit different town to town, especially if you're going back before, you know, the wire was there. Mm-hmm. Possibly even get some journal entries from people's diaries.
Right. Or blogs, whatever's going on then. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or Paul's letters like 40, 50 years later.
So reliable. And you know what's so funny about Paul? So like half of Paul's books are like, this is the real Paul telling the truth about this thing. And like, you know that it's me because I said this.
All that weird third person shit.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's lots of Bible that's really like that, but Paul really like gets me with that stuff. Like, oh, come on, this isn't really Paul.
Oh, and the conservative way of explaining that is that, you know, these were all churches that he'd worked with, so they actually knew him, and there's probably other letters that we don't have, so they'd be familiar with his writing style, and there would be people trying to be imposters of him. So, obviously, he had to try to make the case that it was actually him.
Right, right. But that's what they said.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, and had to do that to, outsmart the imposters who would be doing the same exact thing.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, wait, no, this is really me, for sure, Totes.
It's my Totes.
Okay, but no, that other guy, that other letter, not me, this one's me, okay.
Yeah.
Really? All right, that's the best you got. All
right. And but yet there aren't any parts that say, no, that other one wasn't me. That never made it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely, definitely, we got all the real ones in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, complete with different vocabulary and writing styles.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, too. Yeah, as a classics person, you know, this is what I thought I was doing in college. I thought I went to college to read the Bible more closely and, like, get to know it and maybe try out my theologian wheels. And, you know, I got too close and just, you know, I don't know how it worked out for you, Dustin, but I was like, great, like, really? This is what, you know, I was underwhelmed by their authenticity, but then also like just the quality of knowledge, the quality of advice that they're giving people. You're going to go to a church and you're going to say, you know, stop being Jewish or something like that. The law is fulfilled or something like that. And then you go to Hebrews and we're having a slightly different discussion, you know, it's kind of a tricky, you know, but Christianity in my mind has this, the first thing that happens in Christianity that's worth talking about is not the Holy Spirit blowing around and doing whatever happened in Acts. The first interesting thing that happens is that there's a disagreement about what are we going to do with the law? And, yeah. You know, I couldn't get past it or through it.
Because, you know, if you're going to have a church, you have to have church politics.
Right.
And really, that's the most important thing out of all of it. Who has the power and what are they going to do with it?
Right.
Yeah. You know, for me, it ended up being finding out that things weren't as simple as I thought they were. And then just kind of moving through and being like, how do I actually justify that this is accurate? And that was one of the biggest things that kept coming up. Also, just crazy logical inconsistencies. Like, how does the Trinity a thing? Right. It's not actually supported in any legitimate part of the Bible. There's one little add-on in one of the Johannine epistles, but that's it. And it's not in the earliest versions of it. So, okay, somebody added that later. And then just the whole concept of salvation is just insane when you actually think about it.
Right. It's like the worst setup ever. Yeah. I mean, Yeah, I can't. Oh, it's tough. And when people spend their lives doing this stuff, and I have a lot of pastor friends just around my community, and they're so nice and they're sweet and they work hard at doing their thing and they work hard at counseling people and they work really hard at making sure that the health of the community is, as far as they're concerned, is healthy, and they're mostly, I don't know any douchebag pastors or anything like that. But, I really have tough conversations with them about, how it goes and how things are hanging together in the largest sense. For instance, everybody drops the problem of evil on their pastor, as they should. And I feel kind of bad for them because for the past 5 years, all my pastor friends have gotten my problem of evil question. And I'm just really curious about what's the best answer that's out there, and I read I've read enough theologians and to get a sense of what is the best available answer out there. And it's, of course, short. But I really want my pastor friends to know that it's a short answer, and that they should either bite that bullet and be like, hey, here's the best I can do, and we're going to make our way anyway. I'm comfortable with that. Or be like, let's hang up the towel. And I'm not trying, and I'm not trying to convert people, but like, let me ask, let's get you to the fork in the road and, let you, work it out from there.
Yeah. And the problem of evil as far as the conundrums go is one of the most theologized ones out there. Mm-hmm. So there are so many different answers for it. It's really ends up being one of those that it just comes down to what were they told in school as to how to explain it.
Right.
Yeah. There's a few that might have done a few little additions, but there's probably 10 or 15 different ways of responding to it. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if you've heard all of them by now.
I should catalog them, actually, but I've tried to hear, I've accessed as many as I could, for sure. And that's my sense of it as well, because I've definitely heard the same, there's definitely five of them on the FAQ for sure.
Yeah, what worked to deconvert me the best was, how can you actually justify the authority of Scripture to somebody who doesn't believe that already?
Mm-hmm. That's a really great question.
And I came out the other end with absolutely nothing. There is no way.
Right. Yeah. The justification question is really a good one in knowledge. I mean, it has a sour story, I guess. In knowledge in the general sense, it doesn't have such a fantastic answer. I think of, the Getty examples or whatever, this is the famous thing. But in any case, the at least in religion, they're not even getting close to, they're not quite getting in the, they're not even, I mean, they're in the ballpark, I guess, but they're still not dealing properly, I think, with the weight of the question. That's tricky territory for sure. But yeah. I imagine that you have collected all the answers that go with this.
actually, I haven't because, I went through 3 or 4 different versions of it while I was doing my studies, and by the time I was actually starting to get to the core, it turned out it's just existentialism. You accept it because you want it to be true.
Right.
I even had some professors admit that that's why they stuck with it.
Nice.
And that's, if all you've got is existentialism, that's not much.
No, it's not. It's, analogously, that's how I answer the question of why do I eat meat still. But it's true. I mean, just to be soft to them. But I don't have any better than a like, oh, man, I'm really hungry sort of answer, or all of this is what I crave, or this is what I desire answer to this important question, too. So I'm so Western.
Nice.
Does it taste good?
That's a bone.
I have a little bit better answer on that one. I'm allergic to almost all nuts and about half of fruits.
Okay.
So it would be a little bit more, it'd be a real inconvenience to make sure I actually got sufficient nutrition without taking advantage of animals doing the work for me.
Oh man, I'm going to have to use that one.
Yes. That's not a bad one at all.
Yeah. I mean, I'm allergic to walnuts, but that's really all I know of. I'm gonna have to say that, though.
I think you're in the game, Wesley. Yeah. I think you're right in there. Food, I am food constrained.
Yes.
And thusly, I need some more options.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take another break.
Not bad.
We love hearing from our listeners. You can email us at contact@atheistnomads.com, tweet us @atheistnomads, send us a message on our Facebook page at facebook.com/atheistnomads, or better yet, call us and leave us a message at 541-203-0666. We might even play it on the show. You can also help us out by leaving us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast directory of choice. All right, Chris, what is... what's your history with religion?
It is it's very voluntary. So when I was growing up, nobody in my house went to church, not even on Christmas and Easter or whatever people might do. But I was very interested in Christianity. I have a lot of aunts and uncles, and one of my aunts was Mormon, and one of my aunts was very non-denominational Christian. And,
I got a quick question.
Oh yeah,
that Mormon family member, white or black? Or?
All white. So all my family's white because I didn't meet I don't know any of my biological father's side at all. Yeah.
Okay. So,
all white church people. And you'd go to church and always nice to you as a kid kind of thing. And I wasn't really fooled by that, but I was really interested in what was actually going on. And maybe I was interested in what the adults were talking about more than like the Sunday school sort of stories. And so growing up, whenever I was around, one of my aunts, I would always arrange for myself to go to church. Nobody ever made me. Nobody ever said, don't do it or whatever. And it was actually kind of nice. It was freeing. And I got to learn everything I ever wanted to learn about Christianity. It took a long time. But I would arrange for myself to go. And, the Mormon church was always a little wonky kind of thing. It's a funny place. And I can't quite put my finger on what it was about them. They were all very nice, and I get the whole Mormon talk thing. And they were definitely had cool events. I remember being a teenager and going to like courting events. They'd have like total dances from all over the area for hundreds of miles, and people would come and try to mate when you're 15, and that was great for me. That was great.
Well, they sure know how to program the shit out of everything.
They totally got that down. I would mostly go to, sort of like Foursquare churches, or sort of just non-denominational, maybe just above fundamentalist flavor of churches. But maybe Pentecostal, but, that charismatic flavor. And they were always intriguing. It wasn't the speaking in tongues, but it was like this, there's the speaking in tongues to the prophesying part was always like, what are we doing here? And it wasn't like I wasn't quite smirking yet, but I was like, is this serious? Like, are we doing real stuff here?
How did the two compare?
Well, between the Latter-day Saints church and like my aunt's Pentecostal church.
Yeah.
One was a lot more freeing. I found the Pentecostal church to be more freeing, I guess. You could be more active. The music was better. The, oh, for sure. Maybe the women weren't as cute as a teenager. I mean, that's a thing. But it was freeing a lot of ways. You could really express your however you wanted to express with God, or however you wanted to worship God. You could do that really well. So I think that's, I guess, and I'm kind of, have some puritanical, features about my personality, puritanical disposition, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so like, if I'm going to study something, I'm going to like get all I can out of it kind of thing. Very American pragmatic kind of thing. So the non-denominational churches really suited me. I arranged for myself to go. When I was in the Air Force, I totally took myself to random churches all the time and had, whatever church communities. And it wasn't until I got to private Christian college where I was like, you had to read the Bible very slowly and very carefully, that something became, and it wasn't the first time that actually something occurred to me. When I was 15, I read the Bible for myself for the first time. And I remember thinking to myself that when King David the whole King David and Bathsheba like situation. You know, this, there's a king, he goes and looks out and sees a naked woman, he's like, I gotta have that, and he arranges for that. Oh, she's married, and he has to like finesse the law and finesse all things that were principal to him to like make this happen. And I was like, and God, like, you know, God killed his first son for the, you know, killed his first kid for that. But it was just like King David was wrong. Like, King David was really out of bounds, and then God was like really messed up for killing a kid for being mad at King David. And that kind of bothered me. And you know what? I was stupid for not stopping right then and being like, you know what? This is not how we conduct ourselves. And I mostly blame it on my parents for like not being. I don't blame them, but I say to myself, nobody before that suggested to me that this is not how we conduct ourselves. And not that I was necessarily open to what King David was doing, because it always rubbed me wrong. But nobody was like, hey, this is a no-no, and like this is a thing worth rejecting. Nobody ever suggested that to me. And so as soon as I became aware that this was a thing worth rejecting, I did instantly. And I happened to be in my theology class with a, you know, a world-class theologian, I guess. And nice. I didn't mind telling them.
So kind of masochistic, though. Basically, all of your religious studies, you know, as a child, were self-inflicted.
And absolutely. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And, you know, and there's those Christians who would bite the bullet and be like, you know what? God is sovereign, so he can kill you when he wants to, if your name is Onan or whatever. You know, all of the genocide. I have a cousin who is a professor at a little Bible college, and he totally bites the bullet of, you know, rape in the Bible is okay. And I ask him about this, and you know, I can't ask anything more of him. Like, you're going to bite slavery and rape, and you're going to buy all of those bullets just for Jesus.
Really? And so he goes the full, like, God is great and then mysterious ways.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
But
my professors went a little bit different approach on that. They went with God was dealing with fallen people, so he had to kind of help them back up one step at a time, and tried to put rules in to try to minimize how bad it was.
Did God have to work on their level for a while and do bad stuff because people were bad also?
Basically.
It doesn't.
Yeah. It's not really a satisfying answer.
It's pretty tough. I think that's what I'm surprised by, my, you know, and actually we talked a little while ago about gay marriage, when gay marriage became legal, or the court ruling that came out, and he posted a thing, and you know, it's hard for him because he's a pretty cool guy. Like, he's part of his head is in 2016 for sure. But then the rest of him is not, you know, certainly his heart and the other half of his brain is not here. And he, once it rubs him, you know, and he's not even mad about it. He's just trying to tiptoe back into a place where, you know, nobody's going to go back there. And, you know, he just basically thinks it's wrong, and he doesn't really give, he just kind of says, this is what it is, and we're going to carry it out as well as we can. And if you don't want to, then like, I'm okay with some people going to hell. And so the question becomes for him, the question I ask him is, how many people do you think are going to be in hell, and how many people do you think are going to be in heaven? And you know, and I, and then later, you know, eventually I usually hoist the, like, you know, torture is so good on him. but the idea is like, how, you know, where on the spectrum of humanity do you think this is all going to shake out? And, you know, and he isn't so privy to classical cultures, for instance, for example. So he doesn't know, like, he doesn't have a sense of, you know, what humor was in classical culture, or what punishment meant, or what it even means to eat. He doesn't have a good sense of like how things were kind of going on then. He's really rationalizes a lot of things from a Western perspective. And it doesn't, you know, it's not really helping him out that much.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and you tend to get that a lot more in the more conservative side of things, because at the point that you have to start looking at, you know, what was going on in the culture at the time, and you try to read it in that context, it's a lot harder to stay conservative.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, just for the fact that women vote now, and that Black people are, you know, whatever our status is, we're not slaves anymore, but we're still not having jobs and whatever else kind of goes along with that. Like however you work that flavor of things out. Yeah. I mean, you can't
not. Equal on paper.
Yeah. Yeah. There we go. I think that's right. They spend the same money as we do, but yeah, no, I think it's hard. I think understanding reality is hard for Christianity is my sense, you know, at the end of the day.
Definitely. Unless you get into the very, well, and actually, yeah, no, it just straight up is, because you either have reality is difficult to hold a grasp of along with the conservative beliefs, or you go so liberal that you don't believe what you believe was real, but then the real world actually makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I know. That definitely cuts both ways. Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, you know, in the idea, you know, the underlying idea is to not be dogmatic. Like, there's no doxa to how things kind of go. I mean, we might be the species right now, but, you know, in 100,000 years, we're probably not going to be the species anymore.
Oh, yeah, we'll definitely be well different by then, if we're still around.
Right, and so, you know, you can't, it's very unwise to go, even within a single lifetime, allowing yourself to think the same things all the time.
Yeah.
Or that the rules aren't going to change.
All right. Well, it's time for our last break.
I just want to say, I always like the thought of everybody and everything is a transitional species. Anyways, yes.
I like that notion.
Definitely.
If you like the show, consider giving us some financial support. To make it really easy with one-time donations, or to support us on a per-episode, monthly, or even annual basis using PayPal or Patreon, find out more at atheistnomads.com. Use the links on the right side of the page. $1 an episode is all we ask. Please, think of the kittens.
All right.
Yeah, progress definitely does not stop.
Not even if you wanted it to.
Yeah. You know,
like your cousin.
I have a dirty little secret to tell you guys.
Okay.
So when I was in college and still not quite out of religion, I was, you know, as one does, you go to internships, you take internships at jobs. And for a little while, for about 7 or 8 months, I worked for the Discovery Institute.
Oh,
nice.
Yeah. And it was a very fascinating experience that has definitely altered the way that I it changed my profession, it changed what I thought I wanted to do and who I wanted to work for, that kind of thing. It was really like a, you know, they were pretty, by the time I got there, they were already sort of under fire. The court case proceedings in Ohio versus whoever the case names were.
Kitzmiller?
I think that's right. Yeah, Kitzmiller
versus Dover.
Okay, that's right. And I started working there when that was going on. And
so what year was that?
Would have been 2006.
That's 2005 was Kitzmiller.
Okay. So 2005 to 2006.
Okay.
And it was kind of you could just feel how victim-y the place was. Oh, no. It really felt like that. You know, so the guy, there was a good time
when they were feeling like they just got smacked too, right?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Big time. And everybody was in the house all whiny, like, I think of like David Klinghoffer, and he was this Jewish guy who wrote like a book called The Shattered Tablets or something like that. Would come in every day, and I didn't know any Jewish people. I knew about 10 times as many Jewish people today, thanks to graduate school, as I did then. This guy, David Klinghoffer, was like, he was a fussy guy with me. Like, I was an intern, so maybe it was some of that was that. But certainly there was like a Hispanic guy who was like on their board of things, but there was no Black people. I'm totally the only Black guy that probably has ever worked there. And, you know, so I can kind of, it was kind of, you know, I could kind of just do what I want. And I was, like I said, I was about a foot out of Christianity anyway. And I went to there to work there just to see what it would be like to work at a think tank and to see what these guys' work was really about. I knew there were, let's call them, in quote, scientists trying to do work like Dembski, you know, and they were, people were trying to work out a view of theirs. And it was clear that this isn't how you conduct science in the first place. That was the first thing that I knew, that they had an idea of what result that they wanted in the first place. This is just how you do your work. And they were very explicit about about looking for results that supported their worldview. And I think that's the main reason for their big shun. I think that people wouldn't have been so grumpy or against or sort of anti-Discovery Institute if they were like, hey, I could be wrong about this, but let's just see what happens. And my sense of reading their papers and talking with those guys, that they weren't about, you know, trying to figure out what the answer was. They were like, hey, how can we squeeze this in? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to come up with a perfect philosophical puzzle that nobody's going to be able to solve, and we're going to, you know, force our idea in there.
Well, they're in the position where scientists hate them because they don't do science, but they claim to. Liberals don't like them because, well, again, they're trying to screw around with science wrong, and conservatives don't like them because they're too liberal.
I haven't thought about that last piece, but I was with you all the way then. But I think you're right about that. I mean, well, clearly you're right about that.
I never liked the Discovery Institute. They were either too liberal with their interpretation of things, or batshit crazy, insane, religious people.
Yeah. Tough. And it's tough to be out there for them. I mean, I felt bad. I was a little, you know, you go out in public with the Discovery Institute, and it got embarrassing, actually. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm here with these people. And, you know, they would have, like, they do the whole political thing where they have other arms. So there's the Center for Science and Culture. That's their big intelligent design group. But then they also have a thing called the Cascadia Institute. And they were all about transportation policy in the Cascadia District. So California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. There are people out there who have an idea of wanting to build one big long transportation system out here that's maybe whatever, nitrogen based or something like that, or alternatively mm-hmm. fuel. And so there's some cool nuggets tucked into there, and they, you know, they would have parties in their house with, you know, Department of Transportation people from all of these places. And so they were like, you know, so they're the other facets of this Discovery Institute were pretty genuine, I think. But they and the person who runs that is a guy named Bruce Agnew, who publishes a lot in the Seattle Times and PI. And they're not, I'm not going to call them clever, but like, they're not horrible ideas. They're not horrible things to advocate for. And so, you know, they're you know, to not take away, you know, just to add to be fair to their case, they were trying to do a lot of things. And they were trying to do a lot of things for people that they identify with. And I think, you know, and sometimes you just end up in the business end of either knowledge or money.
Mm-hmm. So the Cascadia thing, I mean, I've heard people talk about this forever in Washington State, mm-hmm. about breaking off from the U.S. and making their own country, because I guess technically we kind of could support mm-hmm. ourselves. But were they trying to do it just for that, or did they want to make like a Christian nation out of it? I'm guessing.
Oh, my sense was that it was very, very transportation oriented, because they didn't even and you know, they had a couple of frankly, just terrible ideas about how to shape transportation policy in the state. And I'll give you an example. So one big push that they wanted to do was they had this trails and rails idea that they would use. Property that was used for trains, and, you know, like the Sounder, for example, and they wanted to put like bike trails next to these things, and they would try to run them through neighborhoods. You know, the idea was that they wanted to run them through neighborhoods, and it was just kind of like, you know, like, I'm not really, you know, I'm not sure, like, I'm not going to speak on the statistics related to people with bicycles doing their hobby or whatever next to trains and how that kind of shakes out. But you could probably get an idea that Rails and Trails, you don't generally, they may or may not go together.
Well, it depends on if they're like, if the trains are up in the air or not.
Well, no, no, the trains would be on the ground. It's like it's literally like rails on the ground and here's a bike trail next to it. And the idea is just to get them out of public, you know, public land. But, oh man, just the safety issues alone.
The safety issue is just the amount of wind shear you'd be dealing with when a train goes by.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, now, in the shape of the trail,
bikes and rails work when you remove the rails and you just have a nice level or easy grade bike path.
Yes,
there's one of those in northern Idaho that, from what I hear, is absolutely amazing.
Okay, so it was more like a bikes or rails kind of thing,
and they the trains bikes. Had been discontinued. They tore up the tracks. And so it was, just this nice, easy grade to get up into the mountains on a bicycle.
Oh, nice. Nice. No, I think that's a clever idea. I think that's right. I think that, you know, it's 2016. We don't, however we ship things. I just think we're not using the rail lines as much as we used to. There are ample of them that are available that are empty. Or people trying to make money off of them. I guess that's probably what goes on the backside. But you're right. Nice, easy way, like easy access for people to do things that in a sustainable for the community ways is just a much better idea.
Mm-hmm.
I love the idea of like the light rail that goes from like SeaTac to Seattle, you know, and it's up in the air for the most part. And, you know, rails and trails would work well with that. You know, just have a bike trail underneath the frickin' train.
Right.
That would be cool. And, you know, a community train, I think a lot of people would use that if it was actually available, where it actually stops through neighborhoods. I don't know.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think they were probably, you know, groping towards something like that, you know, eventually trying to find a good idea, I guess.
Well, what I think is really one of the biggest issues is you have what should be the final leg of the journey all being handling the entire journey. So you have long haul trucks, triple trailer trucks doing long distances. That is nowhere near as efficient as if that was on a train. Yes, it'd be a little bit slower, but it would be a lot more efficient. And if enough of that was being used, it'd be a lot cheaper. And then you just use small trucks for more of the local deliveries or getting to rural places that you wouldn't have train stations in. The same thing works with transportation. There's areas like the Seattle area where buses and trains compete, and the buses are better in a lot of situations.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you had the train as the central link in the infrastructure and buses just got you to that final little bit, you could have some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I agree with that, actually.
I always come from the Japan angle, where trains are freaking everywhere. And they crisscross everywhere. There's different speeds of trains on the same track. So it's actually really cool. So, you know, if you can, say, pick the green line, which is the slowest train, stops at every stop. You have the reds, which only stop at major stops. And then the blacks that only hit, like, towns.
Okay.
So you can like speed through stuff really quick and get here and there. And, you know, you only have to walk really maybe a few blocks before you hit a train stop, really. So they're everywhere. It's amazing. They're fast. They're cheap. They're on time. It's, from what I understand, they're like better than Germany's trains.
Hmm.
But,
nice.
I don't know, man. I think it's one of the worst things in our nation that we don't take care of our railways like we are supposed to. Because like you're saying, the ability to move infrastructure around, like all these supplies from one end of the country to the other, is just mind-boggling with a good train.
I live in Boise, and in the Treasure Valley, there's a lot of people who commute long distances. And like in particular from Napa Caldwell area to Boise and vice versa. And so you end up having huge traffic bottlenecks on the freeway when there could be a central train line that just runs basically parallel to the freeway, go from downtown Boise to downtown Caldwell, and it could cut travel times drastically. It could free up the capacity on the freeway. They could probably drop lanes in a couple areas. And it's the perfect area to try to do like a medium-sized city mass transit system, because buses don't work. But if you had a train that ran right down the center, and then every mile or two, shuttle vans running north-south, it would work beautifully.
I like that idea.
I'd be all for that.
Yeah.
Just have the trains go the long-ass distances past the highways, and then buses when you get to the towns.
And it's the perfect place for it, because the freeway basically does east-west. The trains do east-west. And where people live is north or south of that.
Oh, I like that.
This is something that I've thought of, and then found out they've already been trying to get this to happen here. But the people who want it to happen and the people who would fund it are not seeing eye to eye.
Right. That's
right. So they're Republican.
Let's put it this way. The Democratic leadership in the city of Boise loves the idea. The Republican-controlled state government doesn't.
Sounds about on par.
Yeah.
Oh, Idaho.
And the legislature, when they're in session, they just want to get through it as quickly as they can so they can go back to their real jobs.
They're like, I have so much paperwork at work right now. My law firm is drowning.
I've got a farm to run.
It's farmers and lawyers and a few business people.
Like one doc.
A couple of retired doctors and a couple teachers.
Oh, teachers, man.
Oh, that's a step up.
I'm guessing the Idaho Teachers Union worked it out somehow that they can keep their jobs and take 4 months off in the middle of the year to go work in the legislature.
Mm. It's just PE, guys. I mean music.
I'd be thinking if they actually still taught civics, that'd be an awesome opportunity for the civics teacher.
Oh, yeah. About right.
Yeah.
Oh, how would you
still teach physics?
Yeah. Oh, it'd be so great to have your instructors be the person. Oh, you mean like, maybe this is a thing. I would love to, like, if a mayor of every city taught at the high school, and that was just a feature of how mayors get their work done. I go teach high school kids or whatever. This would be a beautiful, enriching experience in the same way that you're
saying. Teach government class.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Is that asking too much?
Well, considering in most cities, mayors are just figureheads. No, I don't think you are asking too much.
Yeah. That's my sense. Or like the commissioners. Yeah. And then if your town has a laboratory, like send somebody to do the science. Like maybe they're like the specialty classes, right? Maybe they're not the core classes. You know, maybe it's not biology, but maybe there's like a, how to act like an adult in science for high school students. I don't know.
Yeah, the problem I see with some of that is the tendency would then start getting towards, especially with the government side, that the students then end up writing all the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And children write terrible legislation. It's slightly worse than what actual politicians do.
I don't know if they could actually do worse.
I don't know if have you been listening to Klingenschmitt?
The few student written bills I've heard of are pretty bad.
Well, they're from like fourth graders whose dad was like, hey, well, maybe the dad was an attorney or whatever, but
please make our state animal a marmot.
Yeah.
Okay, there was one here in Idaho. I actually got to meet her. She was started it when she was, I think, 10, trying to get the state to have a state amphibian in Idaho.
Okay.
The Idaho giant salamander. It's something pretty much only, I think they've been found once or twice in Montana, but other than that, only found in Idaho. They're about a foot long, pretty cool thing. And she was trying to get the legislature to do it and kept pushing. It took her 4.5 years to get it actually passed. And it had all started as just some little letter writing thing that they had to do for social studies class in like fourth grade. And it took her till eighth grade to get it finished.
Wow.
Well, that actually sounds like it was right on track then.
Yeah.
4 years.
And what was funny was that last year, so it was last year that it finally went through, they had said that no, they would not be giving it time. because they had more important things to do. Then they started doing some really unimportant things in the legislature. So finally they got enough flack that they went ahead and gave it a vote. And there was actually, I think one of the committee members in the committee that had to go through that actually said to her, "All right, if we pass this, will you leave us alone?"
Oh no.
Yes.
Yes. They like, just wanted her to go away.
I'm leaving the state for college since you guys are taking forever. Who wants to be a vandal? Oh, man.
Yeah.
Stay out of politics. You know, in science, here's the thing. You don't even have to conduct an experiment. I mean, you do a little write-up. You do a little publishing, you know, with your clear writing. And you, and then, you know, people are out there commenting on your stuff, and you could be a mover and shaker in not a lot of time. I mean, it might take 90 days to do your thing, do the write-up, send it to somewhere, and, you know, get it farmed out for publishing, and then people will engage in a serious conversation with you. And, you know, I feel like the government doesn't quite go so smoothly, and it's true that science is harsh, but people are working really hard in both spheres, and it, you know, I think one is much more efficient about producing knowledge and producing policy, producing knowledge that's worth, that suggests things that are worth the policy change. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think maybe the government could be more scientific in the way that it conducts itself.
Oh, definitely. I wish there was more scientists in the government.
That's what I was going to say. If we could get more scientifically literate, Peter, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. One idea I heard when I was on the International Air Cadet Exchange was a British cadet who thought our Senate should be more like their House of Lords.
Mm.
Nonpartisan, or at least less partisan, and experts that get appointed to it because they are actually worthwhile. Mm. It'd be kind of interesting if we had like different fields and industries that had got to select people to go there. So like doctors got to pick a couple doctors to serve in the Senate, and physicists got to as well. And it just kind of, it'd be kind of interesting.
That would be kind of interesting. I feel like the different governmental organizations, you know, like the NIH and the FDA and those other groups do a pretty good job of tapping into the expertise that's available. I don't know. It's hard for me to say if they're, I don't find it to be world-class expertise, but I find it to be pretty dang good. I mean, America's just in this position of having so many knowledgeable people, and maybe not always the best universities, but in terms of, you know, the universities in the United States definitely outweigh the world's universities. There aren't other countries that have a better university system than we do, or a higher, you know, at least produce higher quality people from those programs.
Well, the problem I see with that is that, you know, they get the good people in to give them, to feed the government people good information, but those government agencies aren't really listening to that information, or at least in a position to actually put out good policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the FDA, I think one of their biggest issues is they don't have the time. They have too much to do.
Right. I think that's right. My sense of them is that they have a lot. It's a big, very big, complex organization. And I think you're right, Dustin. They do have too much to do, such that you literally like file your paperwork for your brand new device and the FDA doesn't get back to you, then you can start your experiment, or you can start, you know, you're approved. If nobody gets, they're in the situation where you submit something and they don't get back to you, and then that's an okay enough, instead of them getting back to you and saying, "Hey, this is a great idea. We actually thought about this, and let's go ahead." That's a big fundamental thing.
Yeah, and even with just their inspection service, the biologics inspectors, because they're not technically supposed to be that specialized, but they do specialize. They all got pulled over to take care of the peanut crisis in 2008.
Okay.
Basically, everybody working for FDA with a inspector title all had to try to find out what was going wrong with peanuts.
Okay. Wow.
And it put all other inspections on hold.
As long as we're talking about the government, I've got something to report that just got announced on KATU, which is basically one of the main TV stations down in Oregon. Leader of Oregon Occupation, Ammon Bundy, and at least 8 others detained.
Oh, wow.
Holy crap. So,
shots were fired.
Whoa.
But they don't know what's going on really, but KATU News has learned the leader of the armed occupation has been detained along with 8 others. Officials say it all began with a traffic stop while Bundy and some of his followers were en route to a community meeting in John Day, about 70 miles away. Shots were fired, but they don't know who shot first.
Wow.
FBI agents, Oregon State Troopers, and other law enforcement agencies made the stop.
Hmm. One of the Boise local stations is also reporting on it, and they are a little bit less certain on that report.
Hmm. Okay.
They've got question marks, and the only things they have been able to verify is that St. Charles Medical Center in Bend has a helicopter on the ground at the Harney District Hospital in Burns, and that U.S. Highway 395 between Burns and John Day is shut down.
KATU is saying that CNN reports it's unclear who shot first, so apparently CNN is in on this too.
Wow. Yeah. That's, you know, throughout this whole thing, I've been thinking about one thing. A few weeks ago, are we allowed to talk about other podcasts? Yeah, I was listening to Unscathing A. There was Bryce Blankenagel was on there, and he, over a couple of episodes, he told this incredible story about these Mormons who slaughtered these people who were heading out west. And I've been thinking about these guys the whole time, like, you know, they're out up in the mountains or out in the woods or whatever, and there's this Mormon group of people, and there's, I don't know, I just, it, there was a lot of great things that Bryce laid out in his description of that episode that really, not that they sounded analogous in any way, but there was just a lot of like interesting features, you know, so Mormon.
the Bundys and a lot of the heads of these, whatever you want to call them, terrorist groups or freedom fighters, whatever bullshit, are Mormons also. So
yeah, it's a fascinating group.
Yeah, we have a survivalist convention coming to Boise, and the leader of that is Mormon.
Okay,
nice.
We're gonna be going to that.
Oh yeah, that'd be awesome.
I will definitely be recording some thoughts, maybe some interviews. It should be interesting.
Man, hang your phone out of your pocket so you can like videotape
all this shit. right. That'd be awesome.
Bring a little DAT, just record.
Yeah. So the KTVB in Boise has a news crew headed to Burns to get the full scoop.
Okay.
I found the KATU one that you were talking about. Looks like they finally just caught them while they were driving.
Yeah, it's not like those motherfuckers have been holed up on that in that place all the time. They're just like trolling around, fucking going to the store and shit and getting Twinkies and other snacks.
You know, it sounds to me like this is a way that the government would like do its work anyway. Hey, why don't you guys come on down to a community meeting here? We're going to like have a discussion about how to do things. And then when you're en route, it's like snap. And I feel like people like... what's his name? Julian Assange. He knows this. He knows not to leave the building.
Except they went to a community meeting last week in Burns with a judge present.
Okay.
At the meeting. Had everybody bitching at them, and they all got to go back to the wildlife refuge.
Okay.
Yeah, even the people that agree with what Eamon and everybody's doing, like, get the fuck out of our town.
Yeah.
The sheriff in this other town that they were heading to is definitely on their side. So definitely willing to back them somehow.
Interesting.
So yeah, I'm very glad they, well, caught them. If that's really the case, we'll see. But,
right.
Ooh.
So what is concerning me about this reporting is it's all being reported by ABC News and CNN from what I'm seeing so far. You would think it'd be somebody local.
I thought KATU was... well, Oregon local.
Yes, but they're citing CNN.
Oh, interesting.
Hmm. Well, still, I can hope.
I know, right? They're like, no, somebody just brought up more snacks and stuff. They're going to be okay for another 3 weeks.
Yeah.
They're going to be fat, but they're going to be okay when they get out of there.
Litter bombs, bags of dicks, and double stuffed Oreos.
All right, Oregon Live has something that looks a little bit better. They have timelines. So 6:18 p.m., a spokeswoman for St. Charles Health System in Bend said that the ambulance was dispatched to Airlink ambulance was dispatched to Burns. She did not wasn't able to confirm how many people it was going to retrieve or whether or not Ammon Bundy was part of them.
So that's just a little over a half hour ago. So we're like, almost live on the shit.
And did confirm that it was on the ground there. 6:13 p.m., Oregon Department of Transportation closed 56 miles of U.S. 395 between Burns and John Day after unconfirmed reports that Ammon Bundy was taken into custody. And that goes from milepost 12 south of Canyon City to milepost 68 just outside of Burns. Damn, that is basically the entire highway there.
Wow.
Oh, man. There's a whole lot of fringe people that have been, well, at least talking like they were going to go down. Some seriously wackadoo kind of people. So this needs to get done.
5:46 p.m. Two people have been shot and Ammon Bundy is in custody, according to a live stream report by Pete Santilli. The self-styled journalist is also reporting the FBI has told protesters at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Harney County that they are free to go and need to leave immediately.
Huh. Well, they're way more kind than I would be.
Yeah, they need to be arrested for
fucking treason.
Treason, sedition. There's a number of things. Vandalism, trespassing. There's so many things they could arrest them for.
They vandalized that Native American dig, didn't they?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Motherfuckers. Just took a fucking plow to it or something.
And Santilli said he was waiting outside the hospital in Burns to actually confirm the reports of the shootings. Crazy. But the Oregonian or Oregon Live could not independently confirm the reports.
Okay.
So, yeah, we have unconfirmed reports. Hopefully they're accurate.
Oh, man. If those people were any other color than white.
Oh, it would have been a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, wait, you've been there for 20 minutes and you haven't moved along? What the fuck?
Yeah. Oh, I have a guy with a shield and a helmet and a giant stick. Actually, there's 40 of us. We're called the government.
Oh, fuck.
We all watch Thelma.
All right. Well, I think we are about out of time.
Yeah, man. This has been a hell of fun. So glad you came on finally.
Yeah, no, I'm super glad to have joined you guys. Dustin and I haven't had a good chance to chat ever, so this is really, yeah, I'm glad.
And I see you way too often.
I know, right? That's never often enough.
All right, so Chris, do you have anything to plug?
You know, I kind of don't. Get consent when you want to do something with somebody else and it's questionable, get consent. I'll plug for that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a blast.
Awesome. Thanks again.
And for our listeners, we'll be back next week with news.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads. And like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.